So welcome. Here we are in the chapter on Hatha Yoga, roughly midway through. Published on 15 February 1918, and Sri Aurobindo wrote this for the journal Arya, as part of the series on synthesis of yoga, never came back to touch it up, but clearly was informed on the subject, not so much by Swami Vivekananda, who might have been a strong influence upon him, as he approached and wrote about the general topic of the yoga of knowledge, but also especially about Raja Yoga, which we'll take up next time. But Swami Vivekananda was dismissive of Hatha Yoga. Sri Aurobindo is not dismissive. As part of his idea to bring the consciousness of the divine to every aspect of our life, including the body, that Hatha Yoga, this discipline of force, not so much forceful in its application, but awakening and drawing to oneself the force, is one of the plenary aims of his approach. So he does note that it's a difficult and onerous system. Hatha does mean forceful, so one does have to apply oneself to it. But Sri Aurobindo's experience in applying kriyas, etc., in his own personal practice, which are similar to what we have defined in the many textbooks on Hatha Yoga, even in the Hatha Pradipika, there was an assurance that the mastery of the physical by a descending conscious power could affect a change, a lasting and luminous change in the physical. And he was recording minutely these very changes in his record of yoga. And we refer you to that for further information. But while he may look, from the few photographs that we have of him, as a rather Himalayan figure, passive, he was capable of tremendous dynamism, not simply in his assiduous writing practice, but incumbent upon him was to work in commerce with huge forces in the physical and the vital world. And if the physical, if the vital, were left inflexible and small and did not become commodious to the movement of the spirit, then the integral yogin's role in the world would be limited and diminished. So he absolutely fixed himself on this. So let's begin. The Hatha Yoga chapter will pick up in the collected works of Sri Aurobindo on page 531 in the Synthesis of Yoga. The Hatha Yogic system of asana has at its basis two profound ideas which bring with them many effective implications. The first is that of control by physical immobility. The second is that of power by immobility. So the asana is to become one-pointed. We've brought this up before when we were looking at the various elements of the Yoga Sutras, and that its purpose is to establish in each part of the being a focus that is unwavering, ekagrata, so that the attention never moves. In the body, this means taking a posture and not moving. As one sits, all the restlessness departs if one refuses to acknowledge or obey them. The stimulations that call you outward into the world have no power upon you. So this power of immobility is the first. But there is a power by immobility as well. The power of physical immobility, he writes, is as important in Hatha Yoga as the power of mental immobility in the Yoga of Knowledge, and for parallel reasons. In other words, to stop the mind, to make it transparent, so that it can become vast, and in its transparency, and not blocking, not obscuring, to permit a higher light to transfer itself into the earth below through this now luminous, clear medium. To the mind, unaccustomed to the deeper truths of our being and nature, they would both seem to be a seeking after the listless passivity of inertia. The direct contrary is the truth, for yogic passivity, whether of mind or body, is a condition of the greatest increase, possession, and continence of energy. This is not inertia. This is not an incapacity to move, but it's a capacity to become a reservoir, to hold in oneself all light, to hold in oneself all power, and not to be shaken by it, but to hold it and wait for the conscious will to direct the energy. He continues, the normal activity of our minds is for the most part a disordered restlessness full of waste and rapidly tentative expenditure of energy in which only a little is selected for the workings of the self-mastering will. Waste, be it understood from this point of view, not that of universal nature, in which what is to us waste serves the purposes of her economy. The activity of our bodies is a similar restlessness. So nature is conducting one thing and moves along her own routes. But we are practicing yoga, and so have in a sense to break from the ordinary and do something extraordinary. For us, this is a right turn. For nature, nothing is wasted. But for us, to learn how to draw in and hold is a paramount virtue. So he says, the activity of our bodies is a similar restlessness. It is the sign of a constant inability of the body to hold even the limited life energy that enters into or is generated in it, and consequently of a general dissipation of this pranic force with a quite subordinate element of ordered and well-economized activity. It, obviously, is this restless activity. It's incapable of holding the energy typically, and so dissipates it. Moreover, in the consequent interchange and balancing between the movement and interaction of the vital energies normally at work in the body and their interchange with those which act upon it from outside, whether the energies of others or of the general pranic force variously active in the environment, there is a constant precarious balancing and adjustment which may at any moment go wrong. A lot is going on in us, a lot is going on outside. We are up and down. What is out here is a flux over which we have no control. So anything can happen. Every obstruction, every defect, every excess, every lesion creates impurities and disorders. Nature manages it all well enough for her purposes when left to herself. But the moment the blundering mind and will of the human being interfere with her habits and her vital instincts and intuitions, especially when they create false or artificial habits, a still more precarious order and frequent derangement become the rule of the being. Yet this interference is inevitable, since man lives not for the purposes of the vital nature in him alone, but for higher purposes, which she had not contemplated in her first balance, and to which she has with difficulty to adjust her operations. And we are right now talking about nature at the level of the physical, interfacing with the vital. Therefore, the first necessity of a greater status or action is to get rid of this disordered restlessness. Therefore, the first necessity of a greater status or action is to get rid of this disordered restlessness, to still the activity and to regulate it. The Hatha Yogin has to bring about an abnormal poise of status and action of the body and the life energy. Abnormal, not in the direction of a greater disorder, but of superiority and self-mastery. So you can think of it like this, that the body takes a seat. That's what an asana is. It need not always be a sitting asana. The asana can vary according to the will of the practitioner. Typically, let's think of it in terms of a seat. But the pranic nature can also take a seat. And that's in the balancing of the flow of its energies, up and down, even the suspension of the flow of its energy, how it interfaces, how it enmeshes itself, energizes, influences, lifts up the inert body into greater plasticity and capable of expressing more completely the aim of life. Without prana, the body has no empowerment. Prana, vitality, is not our enemy in the practice of yoga. So first, an abnormal poise of status, both in the body and in the life energy. The first object of the immobility of the asana is to get rid of the restlessness imposed on the body and to force it to hold the pranic energy instead of dissipating and squandering it. The experience in the practice of asana is not that of a cessation and diminution of energy by inertia, but of a great increase, inpouring, circulation of force. The body, accustomed to work off superfluous energy by movement, is at first ill able to bear this increase and this retained interaction, and betrays it by violent tremblings. Afterwards, it habituates itself, and when the asana is conquered, then it finds as much ease in the posture, however originally difficult or unusual to it, as in its easiest attitudes, sedentary or recumbent. And if you've practiced Hatha Yoga and had to hold an asana for 5 breaths or longer, you know whereof he speaks. But note that there were many times in his personal practice of the kriyas that he lists in his record of yoga where he could sustain a posture for 45 minutes or 3 hours, sometimes easily and sometimes through the forceful application of his will. It becomes increasingly capable of holding whatever amount of increased vital energy is brought to bear upon it, without needing to spill it out in movement. And this increase is so enormous as to seem illimitable, so that the body of the perfected Hatha Yogin is capable of feats of endurance, force, unfatigued expenditure of energy, of which the normal physical powers of man at their highest would be incapable. And of course, this was a secret power of Hatha Yoga from the first time it was originated, whatever it was called, when it came into India, practiced not by Hindu or Buddhist, but by people who devised it, either in China or in India, wherever, however, it eventuated into Kashmir, and then was transmitted through the rest of India through the forms and the processes we know. Many of the tantras which capture versification speaking to this came about not in Kashmir, but in latitudes much to the south. So from the, say, the middle centuries, from say 300, 400, 500 CE on, we have Hatha Yoga becoming more and more codified, borrowed by Vajrayana Buddhists, borrowed by Shaivite Hindus, and brought into their particular practices. But it was the practice that was effective, that was interesting. It was the effect that it had on the body to make it luminous, to make it light, to make it powerful, to sustain it over longer decades than life normally allotted. He continues, for it is not only able to hold and retain this energy, but to bear its possession of the physical system and its more complete movement through it. The life energy, thus occupying and operating in a powerful, unified movement on the tranquil and passive body, freed from the restless balancing between the continent power and the contained, becomes a much greater and more effective force. In fact, it seems then rather to contain and possess and use the body than to be contained, possessed and used by it, just as the restless active mind seems to seize on and use irregularly and imperfectly whatever spiritual force comes into it. But the tranquilized mind is held, possessed, and used by the spiritual force. Give me just a moment. Mrityunjoy, I'm sorry to disturb you, but could you mute your device? Well, this is the first. I'm going to ask one of you to send a text message to Mrityunjoy Pani and ask him to mute his device. Thank you. We'll try to continue. Samesh, can you still hear me? Thank you. The body, thus liberated from itself, purified from many of its disorders and irregularities, becomes, partly by asana, completely by combined asana and pranayama, a perfected instrument. It is freed from its ready liability to fatigue. It acquires an immense power of health. Its tendencies of decay, age, and death are arrested. So this is a promising conversion. This is a reversal of primacy leading to transformation, where the vital is able to influence the physical. and not so much the physical be turned upwards to receive the vital, but the vital now being able to empower the physical with less resistance. And the consequence of this is this freedom from fatigue. The body is able to continue to work ceaselessly. And we should be clear that Hatha Yoga, from its earliest years, and especially as articulated in the Nath Sampradaya, is not aiming at anything small. It is aiming not simply at the discovery of the immortality of the soul within, but the actual imposition on the body, the capacity to live unendingly. We don't say physical immortality, but to impose upon the body a resistance to the forces of disintegration in the universe so long as one wished it to be so. So back to Sri Aurobindo's text. And let's read that last sentence again. It is freed from its ready liability to fatigue. It acquires an immense power of health. Its tendencies of decay, age and death are arrested. The Hatha Yogin, even at an age advanced beyond the ordinary span, maintains the unimpaired vigor, health, and youth of the life in the body. Even the appearance of physical youth is sustained for a longer time. You may remember Sri Aurobindo in his reminiscences speaks about a yogin whom he knew that lived on the banks of the Nilmata, and who he took to be 200 or 300 years old, and had sustained himself simply through the mastery of this connection between vitality and physicality. They are not necessarily enemies, and it is not absolutely necessary to drain life from the physical over a period of 50 to 75 years. One can sustain, one can greaten. One doesn't live only in the body anymore, of course. One lives in subtler and subtler forms, which are themselves empowered and made luminous by greater forces from the superphysical worlds. And all of this is telescoped into a waiting and capacious body. Back to Sri Aurobindo. He has a much greater power of longevity. And from his point of view, the body being the instrument, it is a matter of no small importance to preserve it long and to keep it for all that time free from impairing deficiencies. It is to be observed also that there are an enormous variety of asanas in Hatha Yoga, running in their fullness beyond the number of 80, some of them of the most complicated and difficult character. Yes, true, 84 and better, hundreds. Now, Sri Aurobindo had, within his own experience of yoga, applying force to the body. And hatha doesn't mean simply forceful going out or with difficulty constraining the body, but bringing force in. That is the hatha. Sri Aurobindo had the capacity to drive illness out of his frame, to strengthen it. He noted when he was young that he had a weak body and not a very generous vital nature, not very powerful. But through the practice of yoga, his body became solid and physically strong, and he filled it with an immense vitality, such that the two were married together, and he could, at will, if he chose, apply conscious direction to a forming malady in his system and make it stop and back out. No need to dwell upon it. But each of us in our own lives has an opportunity now and then, when we become unwell, to experiment, to use a growing capacity to wed spirit to the body, to see if we can bring the felicity and the calm of the spirit into the physical sphere, whereby dysfunctions, disagreeable movements retreat to the periphery. It is part of our job to do that. This variety, he's referring to the number of asanas, serves partly to increase the results already noted, as well as to give a greater freedom and flexibility to the use of the body. But it serves also to alter the relation of the physical energy in the body to the earth energy with which it is related. The lightening of the heavy hold of the latter, of which the overcoming of fatigue is the first sign, and the phenomenon of uttapana, or partial levitation, the last, is one result. The gross body begins to acquire something of the nature of the subtle body, the sukshma sharira, and to possess something of its relations with the life energy. That becomes a greater force, more powerfully felt, and yet capable of a lighter and freer and more resolvable physical action, powers which culminate in the hatha yogic siddhis, or extraordinary powers of garima, mahima, anima, and lagima. Well, these four, garima, means to become immovably heavy, so that if you want to sit undisturbed, no power on earth can move you. Mahima means that you become infinitely large. You assume greatness. Anima means that you take a subtle position. You become very small, microscopic, unrecognizable, undetectable. Lagima, that you feel lightness. You become weightless. So this obviously leads to the capacity to soar and to become a skywalker. Of course, there are four others. There are the Ashta siddhis, you know, the eight siddhis, and the others are prapti, which means being capable of traveling anywhere at will, prakamya, which means to achieve any wish, to do anything that you like, ishitva, which is to control nature and all beings in the vital plane, and vashitva is the last, to control all material forms and forces. So those are the eight. We continue. Sri Aurobindo here says, moreover, the life ceases to be entirely dependent on the action of the physical organs and functionings, such as the heartbeats and the breathing. These can in the end be suspended without cessation of or lesion to the life. This reminds one also of his comments in the 1920s when a certain person came to him to learn meditation, and Sri Aurobindo put him in an experience of nirvana, let's say, and his breath was suspended. And then he got frightened. He said, will I ever breathe again? And broke out of that deep consciousness. And Sri Aurobindo said, I was not so patient in those days, and I let him lose that experience. He must have been annoyed. But this kumbhaka, to become like a jar and hold. Kumbhaka, practice in Hatha Yoga, of course, you keep your mouth shut and you close your nostrils with your right hand, thumb and finger of your right hand. And you don't allow breath to come in and go out. Then you discover, it is possible to breathe without breath. It is possible to draw in prana without having to depend on the physical lungs. One of the secrets of that sadhana. All this, however, the result in its perfection of asana and pranayama, is only a basic physical power and freedom. The higher use of hatha yoga depends more intimately on pranayama. Asana deals more directly with the more material part of the physical totality, though here too it needs the aid of the other. Pranayama, starting from the physical immobility and self-holding, which is secured by asana, deals more directly with the subtler vital parts, the nervous system. This is done by various regulations of the breathing, starting from equality of respiration and inspiration, and extending to the most diverse rhythmic regulations of both with an interval of inholding of the breath, kumbhaka. In the end, the keeping in of the breath, which has first to be done with some effort, and even its cessation become as easy and seem as natural as a constant taking in and throwing out, which is its normal action. But the first objects of the pranayama are to purify the nervous system, to circulate the life energy through all the nerves, the nadis, without obstruction, disorder, or irregularity, and to acquire a complete control of its functioning so that the mind and will of the soul inhabiting the body may be no longer subject to the body or life or their combined limitations. So, physical illnesses, imperfections, irregularities, emotional disturbances, because of this marriage of asana and pranayama into this physico-vital system, begin to abate. You become freer and more plastic, and your life eases. The power of these exercises of breathing to bring about a purified and unobstructed state of the nervous system is a known and well-established fact of our physiology. It helps also to clear the physical system, but is not entirely effective at first on all its canals and openings. Therefore, the Hatha Yogin uses supplementary physical methods for clearing them out regularly of all their accumulations. The combination of these with asana, particular asanas, have even an effect in destroying particular diseases, and with pranayama, maintains perfectly the health of the body. But the principal gain is that by this purification, the vital energy can be directed anywhere, to any part of the body, and in any way with any rhythm of its movement. The mere function of breathing into and out of the lungs is only the most sensible outward and seizable movement of the prana, the breath of life in our physical system. The prana has, according to yogic science, a fivefold movement pervading all the nervous system and the whole material body and determining all its functionings. Well, at least in one of the listing of those five, they would include prana, which is the inward and downward movement focused in the head, the lungs, and the heart. Apana, which moves out and down from the lower abdomen. Samana, which spirals from the navel. Udana, which is upward moving from the diaphragm and throat. And Vyana, which is outward, the circulation from the heart out. The Hatha Yogin seizes on the outward movement of respiration as a sort of key which opens to him the control of all these five powers of the prana. He becomes sensibly aware of their inner operations, mentally conscious of his whole physical life and action. He is able to direct the prana through all the nadis or nerve channels of his system. So you see, now the soul within becomes sovereign, is able to direct the pranic energies into the body at will, to focus on a spot, to develop a new flexibility, to empower an area that has not been empowered before. He becomes aware of its action in the six chakras, or ganglionic centers of the nervous system, and is able to open it up in each beyond its present limited habitual and mechanical working. So these chakras, these wheels or circles, are centering points in the various planes of our being. He gets, in short, a perfect control of the life in the body, in its most subtle nervous as well as in its grossest physical aspects, even over that in it which is at present involuntary and out of the reach of our observing consciousness and will. So some things which operate only automatically, Sri Aurobindo suggests, can become a member of the conscious control of the being. Thus, a complete mastery of the body and the life, and a free and effective use of them established upon a purification of their workings, is founded as a basis for the higher aims of Hatha Yoga. Remember Shaucha, how strongly present purity is in the yamas and niyamas of the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It is the first thing to establish purity. All this, however, is still a mere basis, the outward and inward physical conditions of the two instruments used by Hatha Yoga, body and life. There still remains the more important matter of the psychical and spiritual effects to which they can be turned. So now he's going to turn to the inner discipline that leads to the consciousness, the direct awareness of the divine. This depends on the connection between the body and the mind and spirit, and between the gross and the subtle body on which the system of Hatha Yoga takes its stand. Here, it comes into line with Raja Yoga, and a point is reached at which a transition from the one to the other can be made. And in fact, when we move from the early texts on Hatha Yoga and get gradually to the point where Swatmarama brings all into a grand synthesis, he is keen to establish that the ultimate aim of Hatha Yoga is to prepare the sadhak for Raja Yoga. So all the other yogas, Mantra Yoga, Laya Yoga, Hatha Yoga, all have a similar goal, a common goal, to get to the practice of Raja Yoga, where one can plunge into that aware state where the conscious being of the divine is you. You have become that in the state of samadhi. And Raja Yoga is there to take the embodied being all the distance, not merely to separate the consciousness from the physico-vital system and to make limitless the mind, but to place the whole, W-H-O-L-E, into that. So next time, we take up Raja Yoga. So we said we'd continue with this section that we're reading from Savitri last time because we felt it was apposite of what our purpose was here. So we're in book two, the book of the traveler of the worlds, Canto 5, The Godheads of the Little Life. Don't let that dissuade you. And we'll start on page 170. Each part in us desires its absolute. Our thoughts covet the everlasting light. Our strength derives from an omnipotent force. And since from a veiled God joy the worlds were made, and since eternal beauty asks for form, even here, where all is made of being's dust, our hearts are captured by ensnaring shapes. Our very senses blindly seek for bliss. Our error crucifies reality to force its birth and divine body here, compelling, incarnate in a human form, and breathing in limbs that one can touch and clasp, its knowledge to rescue an ancient ignorance, its savior light, the inconscient universe. And when that greater self comes sea-like down to fill this image of our transience, all shall be captured by delight, transformed. In waves of undreamed ecstasy shall roll our mind and life and sense and laugh in a light other than this hard, limited human day. The body's tissues thrill apotheosized, its cells sustain bright metamorphosis. This little being of time, this shadow soul, this living dwarf figurehead of darkened spirit, out of its traffic in petty dreams shall rise. Its shape of person and its ego face, divested of this mortal travesty, like a clay troll kneaded into a god, new made in the image of the eternal guest, it shall be caught to the breast of a white force, and flaming with a paradisal touch, in a rose fire of sweet spiritual grace, in the red passion of its infinite change, quiver, awake, and shudder with ecstasy. As if reversing a deformation's spell, released from the black magic of the night, renouncing servitude to the dim abyss, it shall learn at last who lived within unseen, and seized with marvel in the adoring heart, to the enthroned child godhead kneel aware, trembling with beauty and delight and love. But first, the spirit's ascent we must achieve, out of the chasm from which our nature rose. The soul must soar sovereign above the form, and climb to summits beyond mind's half-sleep. Our hearts we must inform with heavenly strength, surprise the animal with the occult god. Then, kindling the gold tongue of sacrifice, calling the powers of a bright hemisphere, we shall shed the discredit of our mortal state, make the abysm a road for heaven's descent, acquaint our depths with the supernal ray, and cleave the darkness with the mystic fire. Om Tatastu. Yes, surely we shall. Namaste. Jai Ma.